Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 268. What's changed about learning Python over the last few years? What new techniques and updated advice should beginners have as they start their journey? This week on the show, Stephen Gruppetta and Martin Broyce return to discuss beginning to learn Python. We share techniques for finding motivation, building projects, and learning the fundamentals. We provide advice on installing Python and not obsessing over finding the perfect editor. We also examine incorporating LLMs into learning to code and practicing asking good questions. And Stephen shares details about our upcoming 8-week live course, Python for Beginners, Code with Confidence. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, I got two of my coworkers here on the show this week. I got actually people have been on the show a couple times now. So Stephen Gruppetta, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Chris.
And Martin Broyce, welcome back. Gosh, you were like my second guest.
Yay. I'm not on here that often, but I'm here sometimes, popping up once in a while.
Oh, nice to have you back. And a lot's changed since I started the show, and one of the things that hasn't changed is there's still a ton of people wanting to learn Python that are beginners. We often talk about people coming from other languages, but there's actually quite a few people that are just coming brand new to the language, and a lot's changed in the landscape. And so I thought it'd be fun to talk about this. Also, we have opportunity happening with Real Python right now with a brand new live course, which was mentioned a week ago or so, that if you're interested in checking out, we'll also talk a little bit about that today. But yeah, what is good advice for people learning Python right now and being a beginner right now? And Martin, maybe you can talk a little bit about your background of teaching. You were doing boot camp stuff. Was that often pure beginners?
That was all of the boot camps that I did were pure beginners. Yeah. So, I mean, people might have tried it before, but it was geared towards people who are just starting out with programming and Python. So, Python as your first language and just starting out to do programming, basically.
And, Stephen, that's a big part of your background, too, right?
Yes. Well, if I go further back, my first teaching experience was at university. I'm a physicist by training. So, I actually taught undergrads at university level for 10, 12 years. And then that's when I shifted to Python and I traded physics for Python. So, and I've run courses at most levels, intermediates, beginners.
How far back are you going to go, Stephen? When I was a kid, both of my parents are teachers. So when I was a kid, I used to always teach my classmates.
I did do a bit of that in my high school. So,
I have a teaching background also, as we've discussed multiple times on the show, more on the audio world, but it's been fun talking to other teachers and figuring out this stuff. In fact, I'm hoping to have Kelly from Teaching Python on soon to discuss a little bit of this also, and more in the classroom sense. But the focus of the show often is people find the podcast and often they're a total beginner and are trying to do a bit of the immersion thing like I did when I was starting to learn Python. What were some of the things you wanted to bring to the table here? Like, is there some initial advice that you would have that is unique this time through? Maybe I'll start with Martin.
Unique advice? Oh, dear.
It doesn't have to be, but...
Yeah. It's probably not going to be unique. I'm still going to go back to, I guess, like two things quickly. Is like one, it really makes a difference if you have some vested interest in learning the thing that you're learning. For programming, I feel like there's a lot of possibilities for that, but just something you want to build a little tool to automate some of your workflow, for example, is like it's a very clear, straightforward entry that gives this practical aspect to it that makes sticking with it just a lot more interesting. So I think that's one piece, because you know, this whole learning something new takes a while. So if you have a good reason to stick with it, then that's going to make it more likely that you will. And that's actually necessary for you to learn it, in my opinion. So that would be one.
Yeah, it really explains a lot of the automate the boring stuff thing that I saw at the job when I was just learning Python. That was the book that they were passing around inside of an office. And I feel like that's a core sort of set of people who are actually out in the work world and are looking at ways to automate things in their life. Do you see that in younger students too, like finding a project for them to do?
I mean, I feel like if you're in a teaching position, then it's your job to also help people find those projects if they don't come with those projects, because this, right. The project-oriented learning still like is very helpful, I think. Maybe you don't really have that idea beforehand if you're coming to something that you want to learn, but then if you have a good framework or a good teacher or a good mentor, then they can still help you find that personal project or that personal twist to a project that they have for you that makes it interesting, I think.
To add on to sort of what Martin mentioned, I mean, having those projects, whether it's projects you really want to do, or if you don't have any of those, you still find a project which is putting context to what you're learning. But I think even the learning materials you're looking for, sometimes there's learning materials that are just teaching you the facts. Sometimes there's a bit more of a narrative linking things together. Mm. And I think that makes such a difference in how well you understand something. Something we always do, I do when I'm teaching, we do it here at Real Python, is that it's not just about learning how to do things in programming. It's also learning why you do them the way you do. And I think that answering that why question helps beginners take these pieces of the jigsaw and sort of put them together.
So I think what I was saying before, that you have the project in mind that you want to do, this presents that personal narrative that you have to it. But I totally see what Stephen just said also, that if someone else helps you find a narrative, a good narrative that you're happy to follow, then that can probably also replace or support not having your personal project in mind already.
I think I get some of what you're saying there. Part of it is a lot of people that want to learn a language, a skill, and there are books that are out there that will push you toward, will just create something. And then they kind of turn that around and say, okay, this is the example of what you have built and why this works and why these constructs. It's kind of like getting people to do something pretty early on is almost more interesting for a student than just simply like, I'm going to lecture you about what variables are, what all these data structures are. We're going to actually just start using them. The kind of like, don't be super concerned. And there's different students, right? There's different people that they really, really want all the explanation, or maybe they're again coming from another language and they want like, okay, well, how's this compare to my language? But I agree that often it's fun to just like go on this journey and start doing stuff. It's kind of like almost like seeing a magic trick and then having your interest peaked of like, oh, now I'm going to learn how I did it, you know, and figure out what's happening as far as the constructs that are inside of it. I don't know if that's tying some of that together, but I see that. And that's the other trick, is there's so many different kinds of learners. And it is one of the things that I think we'll hit on as a theme, that a lot of people are skipping way ahead and using something like an LLM to do a lot of the work for them. And then there's not really hardly any understanding of what's happening.
You mentioned earlier, Chris, about sort of top level advice. And I think something you said just now reminded me of one that I often say. Often beginners want to find the shortcut to get to do the fun stuff really quickly. Say they want to do data science and they don't know any Python, they want to go straight into doing data science or straight into doing web development. And unfortunately, there is no shortcut. Those fundamentals, the basics, you can go quickly through them, but you really need to know them and know them well,
right,
before you can progress. So I think as much as we all love to say, here's a shortcut to get you from zero to hero in 6 weeks, I think it's important to say that there is no way of avoiding learning the fundamentals and learning them well.
I've recently heard something from, I think, Duolingo.
Yes, I do.
They have some sort of a conference. Or I don't know. Like I looked into it for a moment, and one of the founders was talking about there's these streaks. Do you know these Duolingo streaks?
Sure.
It's like if you do language learning and then you stick with it, you do something every day and it gives you some sort of just repeated engagement.
Gamifies it, yeah.
It gamifies it, yeah. But also it makes you, you know, look at this language that you want to learn every day. And he was kind of like, so if you see someone who has like a streak of 1,000 days or whatever, you can congratulate them. They're really being consistent, but it doesn't mean that they know anything, right? Because you can't get this streak fulfilled if you do 3 minutes of learning per day. And that's better than nothing. But really, learning just takes time. Like you need to be spending X amount of hours with a language to actually progress in it. And I think that isn't just true for language learning, but it's true for learning anything. It's true for learning programming, which also is sort of a language, but also sort of, you know, some practical stuff around it. Consistency is great, but in the end, to actually get somewhere, you just need to put in the time. This is,
right,
I guess, fortunate, unfortunate thing. So I feel like as long as you find ways to keep yourself engaged and interested in the topic, that's just going to make you stick with it for the long term. And that's how you're going to learn something.
Yeah, I think the language thing is kind of an interesting comparison in ways that there are people that do just stay in those like repeating verbs and repeating nouns and like learning kind of structural stuff. But then the problem with a lot of those platforms is they've never quite tied it into like, well, let's have a conversation. Let's write something. Because it's much harder to do. And eventually that's the goal. And I feel like that's the same thing here with programming is you really got to start putting it into action and actually writing the code and not just simply like answering fundamental questions and getting little check marks and the simple wins. Again, putting it into action.
And the analogy with spoken languages is actually great. I may have mentioned this in a previous time I've been a guest on your podcast, Chris, but I have this with Spanish, right? So I know a bit of Spanish and I know it well enough to be able to read it to some extent. But if you ask me, can you start speaking now? Or you give me a blank page and say, can you write something in Spanish? I can't do that at all. And I feel that...
That's me for French right now.
That's where we need more Duolingo, right? And that's where I think many programmers hit that point where they learn enough Python to be able to look at some code. And even if they don't understand every single line in it, they understand it well enough. But then give them a blank page, and that can be much harder. And I think it's bridging that gap, which can be hard, but I think it's an important step. And once you get to a point as a beginner where you feel like you have an idea, you start with a blank page and you can write some code, I think that's where the confidence comes. And that's exactly the same with languages. When you get to the point where you can go on holiday and start to have a bit of a conversation. It might not be perfect. You might not get everything right, but you can have that conversation with someone in a foreign country. That gives you confidence. So I think the similarities are apt there.
Yeah. Do you have any things that you have noticed that are different about starting right now?
Well, I think LLMs, generative AI, is the obvious thing to mention. And
yeah,
it's very new. So I think all of us are still trying to explore how it's working, how it can be used from a teaching point of view. It's also changing so much. So whatever we say today might be outdated in a month or two because this is moving so fast. But I think learning how to use LLMs, and I'm sure we'll talk perhaps more in detail about this in due course, but I think learning how to use them right is so important. I'm not sure I have an answer to what is right with using LLMs, but I do know what is wrong with using LLMs for learning.
Sure.
It's like, you know, if you're doing a course or if you're following a tutorial and says, here's an exercise, what you shouldn't do is go to the LLM and say, here's this exercise, can you do it for me? Because that defeats the purpose. So I think there are good ways and bad ways of using LLMs to learn. I think we're still all exploring to find out what they are.
Yeah, as teachers, it's really put a wrench into a lot of people's like literal career and try to figure out like, well, how do I incorporate this thing? One of the things that I've said it on the show a couple times, I think, is their language models. And so you see them being used in language classes and places where people are supposed to be sitting there with the blank page, again, going back to that, and writing something from scratch. And what some teachers have done to incorporate this. Actually, when I spoke with Simon Willis, and he kind of mentioned the same thing about LLMs, is you need to kind of get them to lie to you or get them to produce something and then look at it and then see kind of what's wrong with it. And I kind of feel the same thing with, you know, writing generally. And a lot of teachers are saying, have it write something, but then tear it apart. Be a teacher and look at what's wrong with it. And that's kind of the real hard part with a total beginner is like, you will not know what's wrong with it or what's right with it. And you can kind of start to learn that. And so it kind of becomes frustrating. And so I kind of wonder what the balancing act is of like, how much information do you need to know before you can sort of say, yes, this is properly written and tied together.
Well, I can give you myself as a case study. I'm actually a student at the moment. I'm training to become a track and field coach, which is one of my passions from way back. I've been using traditional means. I've actually got textbooks on my desk. I've been reading, you know those books we get from the shops. And I've been obviously following some courses. But I've also been using LLMs because, well, of course, why not? And I found that after I had done some of my learning from the traditional forms, after I read textbooks, read tutorials online, watched some courses, I could then go to the LLM with a clear idea of what I wanted to ask it. I said, like, you know, this is who I am. This is what I want. These are the techniques I want. I felt like I have the knowledge to be able to prompt it to give me exactly what I want. And when it did give me information, I had the confidence. I may not have known everything it's giving me, but I had the confidence of saying, yeah, this is very similar to what I was reading in the textbook. So it's more likely to be right. And I feel like that gave me the confidence of being able to trust it more rather than if I had gone to the LLM first and said, I know nothing about this subject. You tell me. I think there my confidence would have been much lower.
What has your experience been with this, Martin?
So let me think. While you two were talking now in my head, I was thinking about what do I think about LLMs for learning programming, right? And my answer is I like LLMs and I use it quite a lot for stuff that I do, like personal projects and work, etc. But my answer for learning, I'm not sure it's that helpful for learning per se, because it's very useful for getting things done. But again, going back to the situation of how do you actually learn something is just by putting in time and effort, you know, like you need to, if you want to learn it, you need to put in time and think about it and to try stuff out and be wrong about it. And that's just the time input that you need, I have the feeling, to learn some things. I'm using LLMs more for doing something rather than for learning something for myself, I think. Like, yes, and as a search engine, I'm, you know, replacing my searches to get answers, but this is not for learning something really. I guess I haven't really figured out, maybe Stephen can give me some guidance on how to use it for learning. Yeah, for me at this point, it's more like to do work or to make something happen faster that I would otherwise take longer to do.
It's more of an assistant than it is a teacher.
But I'm sure you can use it like that. I mean, I'm sure you could be like be a mentor, like help me, walk me through this
right
situation. I don't know. I don't understand for loops. Act as a mentor and walk me through it. I'm sure there's really great ways of doing that. I just haven't used it myself.
So again, we're all new in this, but I'll share, and this is again, both my experience as a learner in this other field I'm learning, mm-hmm. but also as an educator, I've been sort of using it with some students. First of all, it's asking it to be a mentor, but making it very clear, look, I'm a beginner. This is what I know. So making it really clear on what level it should give you. Beyond that, I think there are two other areas where I think it's really useful. If you've learned a topic, for example, for loops, try to explain it to the LLM in your own words and then say, can you tell me whether my understanding is correct? And if it isn't, point out where my understanding is wrong. So what you're doing is, we always say, look, the best way to figure out whether you've learned something is to teach it to someone. In this case,
right. You're
teaching it to the LLM, but you're actually telling it, well, you point out whether there's some flaw in my reasoning. So rather than asking the LLM to explain for loops to you, you've learned it, and then you're confirming that you've understood it correctly and there aren't gaps in your knowledge or flaws in your knowledge. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is a very powerful technique.
That sounds nice, yeah. That leads me into the second point that I wanted to say 20 minutes ago. We kind of went somewhere else, but
yeah.
Point two would have been this, like teach it to someone, basically, which is also an old hat, but I feel it works really well. And I see like this, that this could be actually a great thing because you don't necessarily have someone next to you who is interested in learning Python if you're not in some sort of a cohort course or if your siblings aren't interested in learning Python or whatever. or your kids.
Yeah.
But you can always speak to an LLM, right? So that's actually a great use case for the teaching aspect.
And the advantage is that the LLM can actually correct you if you're wrong. Well, hopefully it will do it correctly.
Yeah, that's right.
It doesn't get tired.
It doesn't get frustrated either.
Yeah, yeah. It actually brings up something that has been a part of a few guides that we've had. There's one that we've had on Real Python for a long time, 11 Beginner Tips for Learning Python Programming. And one of the things I liked about it was this idea of, and I feel like we've touched on this before, of how do you ask good questions? And I think that's going to be useful for us, again, if you're going to use these augmented tools also. But what advice do you have for something like that? Like, how do you feel like you can teach someone to ask good questions or advise them?
Well, that's a good question. I think with LLM specifically, I think being specific, and I know you've had guests talking about LLMs, the more specific your prompt is, the better it is. So I think it's being really clear on what you want the LLM to give you. And if it's in the learning environment, you really want to say, look, this is what I know. This is what I'm trying to learn, or this is what I'm trying to achieve. And in some ways, what I found with LLMs is to ask the questions in a structured way. So rather than asking it all in one go, you start by paving the way. Make sure the LLM has understood where you stand, and then you sort of build on that bit by bit.
So I know that's something that you've thought about a lot too, Martin, the idea of asking good questions. Advice on formulating them?
Formulating questions. One of the standard advices that I think is very valid is like give as much helpful information as possible.
Yeah. This used to be like going into like a forum or places like that.
Yeah.
Don't just leave like a vague thing. This isn't working.
Right. That usually doesn't help much.
Yeah.
But I mean, in the context of LLM, since we were talking before, that's also like a great way that you can put whatever information you have, like a trace back or like a very vague idea of something into an LLM and help, maybe it can help you reformulate it into a useful question. That seems like a use case that might be helpful as well.
Yeah. It's a skill like any other thing. Like if you're not, I've developed it as a podcaster, asking questions and trying to like elicit answers from people. And so I can kind of see the same thing as you work with these tools to try to figure out, or just in your learning path, like things that you can find ways to get good information back. We did an episode together early on about how errors are your friends. And I thought that was really great at the time. And then what's been fun to watch...
It's communication.
Yeah, it is. It's exactly. It's not trying to be upset at you. It's saying this went wrong. And what's been fantastic is the last versions of Python from 3.9 upward, they've added so much more detail inside of it. I think it's partly to do with the way Python's been sort of restructured through the PEG parser, that it can kind of go through and find out what's happening underneath it. Did you mean to do this instead of that? And highlighting the particular syntax that could be wrong. And so that alone, I feel like, is such a great way. Anybody coming to the language right now is going to have a much easier time as they experiment.
Absolutely. I think, especially for beginners, I mean, they're useful for everyone, but especially for beginners, those error messages help so much in, because normally I think that was one of the big stumbling blocks when early in the journey when learners are learning.
Yeah.
The error messages, sometimes you get an error message and like, well, what does this mean? And It still doesn't explain everything, but I think it helps to sort of remove that hurdle of, okay, good, my code doesn't work, but why? I can't understand this red text at the bottom of my screen. Whereas now it's a bit more understandable.
Yeah, I really like that about it.
Better error messages and a more accessible REPL, which I feel like is maybe undervalued for teaching, because that's like the tool you have available, and it's such a nice immediate feedback loop where you can, if you use it as a teaching tool, right? Like you write a line of code, you get a response right away.
Yeah.
And the REPL experience has been kind of frustrating. Like I have not used it as a teaching tool back when I was teaching these courses, for example. But now I would, because you can do multi-line stuff. You even get a bit of color highlighting.
Yeah, that copy and paste alone is amazing.
It's just the small things.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't need to do an actual function call when you want to exit the REPL. You can just type exit and that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are like small things, but I feel like for teaching to beginners, it's really elevated the REPL as a tool that is, you know, like readily available and now also has like a couple of these really annoying roadblocks are just out of the way.
Yeah. Just to explain that real quick, just the REPL is the thing that comes with Python. If you type the word Python or Python 3, depending on operating system version, it opens up the read, evaluate, print loop tool that has the little three little greater than symbols, I guess, prompt that you can then start typing into and just start typing Python and getting kind of immediate feedback. You see it in a lot of our demonstrations and a lot of the ways that we teach, but I feel like the name REPL, REPL, is sometimes a little confusing for a total beginner. Yeah. So
thanks for explaining.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I mean, the key is it's an interactive environment. And as Martin said, it's great for teaching, but it's also great for beginners to explore something that they're learning because it gives you that ability to try a line, see what comes out straight away. So it's useful for teaching, but it's also very useful for the learners themselves after they've learned something to go and explore what they've learned in this very interactive environment.
You know what's interesting though, like thinking back to myself starting Python, like another thing that I didn't like about the REPL, I don't know how many beginners have this, but you know, like the code you write is gone basically. And I remember that when I was getting started, I was very intent on keeping every line of code that I wrote like somewhere and like have a copy of it and put it on GitHub, or, you know, I didn't want to lose any code that I wrote basically because it felt so hard to get back somehow. You know, that's something that changes if you wrote it changed for me after writing a lot of code, right? And I don't know, this might just be a personality thing too. But yeah, I mean, I feel if you want to learn something, you just got to do it over and over again anyways. And those lines of code that you write, they're probably not very special. So that's also something to keep in mind. And so you can use the REPL, you can use this interactive environment and just write them and they're going to be gone and it's fine. It's just about training.
I use the REPL in PyCharm and it has a history. So you wouldn't have had that problem there.
Oh.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. We mentioned it briefly in this episode, and it certainly fits the theme. The course is titled 11 Beginner Tips for Learning Python, and it's based on a written article by Chriselle Hardson-Hurley. And in the video course, your instructor, Darren Jones, takes you through multiple learning strategies to make things stick, ways to make your coding more collaborative, and ways to build your confidence through creating projects and contributing to open source. The first step in learning any programming language is making sure that you understand how to learn. Knowing how to learn is essential to keeping up with changes and becoming a successful programmer. And this is a solid collection of tips to help you start your Python journey. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the technique shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. That's something I wanted to bring up is I think often people don't know where to begin as far as like, where do you suggest to get Python from? I have my own advice that I've said on the show many times, which is just to go to python.org and download it from there.
I agree with you.
Same.
Okay. And then from that, you do get a REPL that you can just, again, type Python. And once it's installed, it also includes an interactive editor, the IDLE, the Interactive Development Learning Environment, if I got the name right, which we used as a focus for the Python Basics book. But I know that there were other tools that you may have used when you were teaching students. Other advice there or tools that you think people should start with?
I'd start by, I agree with you, I think the best place to get Python is from python.org. There may have been times in the past where, depending on your operating system, that may not have been the best option, but certainly now, I think for any operating system, it's a good place to go. Then we get to the editor wars, as I like to call them. I think, you know, this one is better than that one, I use this. My advice tends to be to beginners, if you don't have a preference already, pick one. Don't spend weeks and weeks thinking of what editor to use. Just pick one. Start learning Python, which is what really matters. And then when you get some experience, you may want to experiment with VS Code or PyCharm or some of the other editors. personally, I tend to advise learners to pick one of the main ones. So either VS Code or PyCharm would be the obvious ones. I'm not a big fan of IDLE because to me, it feels like it's something you can use initially, but you very quickly need to move on. So might as well go straight to a VS Code or a PyCharm or one of these editors that can grow with you and stay with you for a long time. But that's just my personal preference.
Yeah.
But yeah, my advice is don't get stuck with trying to try every single editor and spend months and months picking your favorite. Just pick one and move on.
It's such a trend that people have. It's sort of, I jokingly called it productivity porn back in the day. Like people like, oh, but I just need another notebook and I need another organization system. Oh, I need another to-do app. I need the perfect one. And it's like, no, you kind of just need to start doing stuff. And it's very easy to do that in the programming world too, because it keeps you busy, but it doesn't keep you moving forward and learning. You have advice there, Martin, or has it changed?
Are the editors wars, like, are people actually still, like,
I think it's less
combating about what's the best? Because I haven't felt it much, I think. Like, I do remember, I remember, and that's before my time, but Vim versus Emacs and things like that, that those were, like, really heated debates.
Right.
But I might also just not in that sphere at the moment, but I've felt that most people I've heard talking about are pretty agnostic about, you know, which tool to use at this time.
Yeah.
Maybe they're just all like pretty similar or in some ways, you know.
You're obviously mixing it with the sensible crowd, Martin. I think there are still some out there who are like, this is the best editor and, you know, you should be using this. But yeah, I think more and more people, I think, are in the more pragmatic side, which the way I see it, whatever works for you. I often tell my students, the best editor is the one you're used to using. And that's it, pretty much.
I feel like notebooks have been kind of this other thing as far as if you're coming from a data science side, and there's been some wrinkles in that. Of course, I've talked a lot about Marimo on the show and my being a fan of that. The idea of what you said about the REPL of this sort of interactivity type of thing and trying things out, but then being able to keep it as a... not necessarily something you're always going to reference to in the case of like the Jupyter ones. We talked about that often on the show, this idea that they're just these sort of archival things that may not even run because you were just literally experimenting and writing down your thoughts and trying things out in little cells by themselves. Marimo changes that a little bit, but yeah. So, I mean, I agree. It's interesting because VS Code's kind of become a bit of a platform because it is sort of open source underneath. I forget the raw name of it, but this new Positron from Posit is based on it. There is some familiarity there if you've played with those.
I guess that's an interesting point, though. Like, there's this new types of editors. I mean, they're not that new, I guess, but they incorporate some sort of LLM usage into their builds in a way. Yeah. So just to make it native that you code with the assistance of an LLM. And I think those are interesting tools to probably get familiar with at some point. I guess I wouldn't suggest it for a beginner at this point.
Yeah.
Maybe in 5 years I'm going to suggest it to a beginner. At this point, probably not yet. But yeah, the advantage is that a lot of the interfaces and the ways of interacting with them are kind of similar, I feel, across the major, like even though PyCharm and VS Code are still like somewhat different, I think a lot of the ways that they work are quite similar. So that if you're familiar with one, it'll work differently. Yeah.
Yeah. The integrations, as far as you're like, you could just ask the question, can it do this thing that I've seen in the other one? It's like, yes, it's just done this way or whatever. The whole idea of integrating a lot of the other tools that we often talk about on the show, like a linter or testing and things like that. That all seems to integrate pretty well together now.
It'll be interesting to see also where these sort of AI-focused tools are going to go, how they're going to develop. Some names are going to drop. Maybe new ones are going to come up. I don't know. Or maybe everything is going to converge to something. But there's like a lot of movement happening there at the moment. Yeah, so if you want to play with it a little bit, I guess you could. But if you're really just getting started, I don't think I'd recommend to start with that.
And to add on to that, you mentioned this sort of the integration of editors that are suggesting code for you. From a learning point of view, I often recommend students when they're with their learning hat on, to turn off those features, because you really want to write your own code. You almost want to do it the hard way. You want to figure out what the name of the function is and figure out how to write your for loop or whatever. And then once you're comfortable with that and you want to increase your productivity, that's when you want to turn on these tools. But from a learning point of view, you almost don't want some of these tools to write the code for you.
Yeah, it's like different skills that you're learning. I guess, you know, learning Python or learning programming, you actually need to do the programming. And then there's another skill that I would argue is probably a very valuable skill also to learn, which is then how to accelerate your workflows with the help of LLMs, for example. Those are not the same things you're learning there. It's two different sets of skills that you're learning.
Absolutely.
And one can get in the way of the other, I guess. You know, that's what Stephen was just saying.
Yeah.
If you think that you're learning to program when you're actually learning how to use those LLM tools, you're not learning how to program, but you're learning how to use these LLM tools. Valuable skill, but not the same. And you should probably do learning programming first.
One of the things I wanted to ask about, because we focused on it a couple times, just sort of touching on this idea of like building something, creating things. Do you have advice on what the scale of a beginner project is? Is it something that you've had to maybe talk somebody back from, like, okay, I want to create this thing? And it's like, okay, well, maybe you should start with this part or something like that. Do you have advice on that, like the scale or scope for a beginner project?
I think, as you mentioned, Chris, starting small and realistic. If you're a beginner, you've never done any programming before, and you're in your early days, you're not going to write a complex program that solves all the world's problems. So I think it's starting small. And then once you're comfortable with the scale of a project you've built, you start with a small project. If you feel like you've completed it successfully, then you can move on to a slightly larger project and a slightly larger project. Rather than trying to go for a large project, you get lost along the way. And then that can be disheartening and takes away the motivation. So I think start small and then grow gradually with bigger projects as you go along.
Do you talk to a student about that and say, I see the idea and the scope of your project. How could we break this apart? Is that something that you would discuss with them?
Absolutely, yes. And often there are ways. You might have some fancy GUIs that they want to do. And you're like, okay, let's keep that for a later stage. Let's strip it down to what are the essentials that you want to get from your program? And often that could be a manageable project. Sometimes even that is too big. But often, once you strip all the bells and whistles, you're like, this is what your project is meant to do. That is in itself a small, doable, achievable project.
And then building on top of that, just like Stephen said, then you grow in scope. And ideally, maybe you even grow that exact project in scope,
right?
Like you start with the core of the project, and then you slowly move towards that vision that you had at the beginning, maybe that was too big at that point. But then you keep revisiting. I think that's a really valuable exercise too, that you keep revisiting what you've wrote and you refactor it and maybe you build on top of it. You're probably going to run into some issues on the way because something that worked before is not working anymore. And then you got to figure all of that stuff out. But yeah, growing a small project into a bigger one, I think is also a great exercise.
Sometimes I hear about people, as far as beginners, being told that you really should pay attention to these things to make your code Pythonic. The idea of PEP 8 or the Zen of Python, and some of these things that we talk about. But I always feel like that may be premature for a beginner conceptually, that they should write some code, get comfortable with it generally before these strictures and these other ideas are kind of put on top of you. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I can tell you what I do when I teach beginners. So I do mention things like PEP 8. But as you said, I said, look, you don't need to worry about them. However, bear in mind that anything I write in my sessions to you, any code I give you, is going to follow the right guidelines. So over time, you may not know that you're doing PEP 8 coding, but you're following the style I'm using. You know, I'm putting spaces around the equals or whatever it might be.
Right.
And that's the advice I give them initially, sort of don't pay too much attention to it, but if you follow the type of code I'm writing, then probably you're going to be using the right style guide anyway. And then at some point later on, they can go and read PEP 8, but certainly not in the beginning, I'd say. It's more important to know how to write a for loop rather whether to put four spaces or a tab or three spaces in the indentation.
I'm just thinking that could also be an interesting use case for an LLM though, right? Like you write your code I'm a big fan of just getting it to work. And then, you know, like over time you refactor to make it better. But maybe you get your code to work and then you throw it in there and you're like, okay, so assess this on the base of, you know, good code style or PEP 8.
Right.
Give me information about what I did wrong and how I should have done it better. Because I think they're like, these tools are probably pretty good at actually knowing what PEP 8 is, especially if, you know, mention it specifically. And they're likely to give you the right advice there. And then that could be an interesting learning opportunity, I think.
And I think that's a great exercise, not just for PEP 8, but you've written some code. You give it to the LLM, say, I'm a beginner or whatever. You explain what level you're at. Mm. Say, can you give me your opinion of the code I've written? How could I have made it better? How could I have made it more Pythonic?
Right.
Bearing in mind the level I'm at, right? You don't want it to suggest something very advanced to a beginner. Mm-hmm. And that's a great way of getting feedback on code you've written and learning something new, because perhaps the LLM is going to suggest, why not use a list comprehension here instead of a for loop? And you think,
right, I was thinking that,
oh,
yeah,
let me have a look at that. What are these list comprehensions? And that leads you to learning something which is at the right level for you.
Right. And hopefully it could provide, you know, more links out to learn more stuff, you know, like, oh, to learn more about this, you know, here. Of course, you always go to Real Python.
I was going to say Real Python links, of course.
Find more stuff. That'd be nice, yeah.
I wonder how good these tools are at giving you that, like, that actual advice appropriate to your level. Like I said, I haven't interacted with it much in terms of me being a learner, right?
Right.
So I don't know, but I feel a little doubtful that it's going to be really good at giving you that well-scoped, you know, like that advice of like that is just right for your learning level. Maybe I'm wrong though, like I'm happy to be disagreed with here.
I think some of the later models, if you prompt them well enough to clarify who you are and what level you're in, mm-hmm, they do a reasonably good job at sticking to your level.
How close do they come to like a human teacher in that sense, in your opinion, if you've tried that?
I think where I feel they're not that good is at filling some of the gaps. What I mean by this is that learners always have some topics they know they need to learn, but there are also topics they just don't know about. They're the gaps that uh-huh, an experienced teacher will put them in a curated textbook or course. But I think the LLM sometimes misses those gaps. For example, you might be at a relatively early stage of your learning, and special methods would come in. These are the things where you can almost ignore them early on. But once you understand that special methods are the glue that keep everything in Python together, all of a sudden everything starts to make more sense. And I think a mentor, a teacher, an instructor, a textbook will introduce these in the right amounts. The other danger is to try to learn. You learn about special methods, say, oh, let me go and learn everything there is to know about special methods. I think it's important to know what to leave out as much as what to put in.
Yeah.
And perhaps LLMs aren't that great at that. And experienced teachers are better at deciding, let me give you a bit of this topic, but not too much, because if I tell you everything about this topic, it's going to be overwhelming. But if you know just a bit of it now, that's going to serve you well in the future. So I think there's still some benefits of having an experienced human teacher, I think.
I think I may actually transition pretty well into what you're up to right now. You're currently building out our beginner course, Code with Confidence. And I think it's interesting to sort of take that into focus as we talk about just generally like learning. Some of the things that we focused on in our little conversation a couple weeks ago was just the idea of accountability is a huge part of that. Just for so many people out there, the idea of like having a regular meeting time. I guess just give us a little background on the course and where people could kind of learn a little more about it.
So this is a course for beginners. There's no prior knowledge that people need to know. And from the point of view of designing the course, it's been quite fun for me, because you might think a beginner's course is always the same. There's always the same topics, but there are so many ways you can create a thread and the way you order them. You mentioned earlier, Chris, on having hands-on projects as early as possible. And in fact, here they come in as early as day one, rather than,
oh, nice,
let's learn about the four and eventually work on a project. Let's put the projects almost straight away in there and start learning by working on a project. So I think that's been quite fun to curate all of this content in an 8-week course. Every day there's material that learners can do whenever it suits them during their day. Everyone's busy. So, but then there's also the live sessions, as you were mentioning. Three times a week, we meet live on Zoom. And we're discussing how we can ask questions to LLMs. And some people find that useful and great. But I think there's still a difference when you ask a question to a human being, an experienced instructor. And I think the conversations you can have from those live sessions are so rich. And from previous experiences with these types of courses, many learners come and say, well, this conversation, this discussion we've had, we've perhaps gone off a tangent, and then we've sort of weaved our way back to the main topic.
Right.
And it's that journey that means that I get it. I've got that aha moment.
Yeah. There's like inspiration hiding in there too, of watching other people have their aha moments and kind of wake you up to something. Oh, wow, I didn't even think about it this way, like the way that classroom conversations can be. Yeah.
Plus also you actually get to know the other people in there. That's a big difference, in my opinion, to talking to an LLM about it. Like you can have like some sort of a continued relationship with the people that you're in a cohort with together. I feel like from my teaching experience, where those were in-person boot camps, but that was a really rich experience too, that you get to know other people who are on the same journey. You're on a similar path and you get to know each other, and then you can continue having a relationship throughout. I mean, not with everyone, but if you get along well, why not? And this can be like even professional contact at some point, you know, people all go forward in their paths. And then if you're on a similar trajectory, that's always interesting to have someone that you know.
And with these conversations, because it's small groups, you need small groups, right? You don't want too large groups. But you were asking earlier, Chris, on how to ask the right question. And when you have a group of 10 people, you may ask a question in a certain way, but then someone else may ask the same question in a different context, perhaps in a different phrasing. And you might be, that's what I wanted to ask. So I think having a group learning together, one-to-one is great, right? But having a group, between the group, you're going to have different people coming up with different ways of asking questions, different insights. And that's what I mean by the conversation is as important as the learning how to write your for loop, as it were.
Yeah. So just some details on the course and where people can learn more.
Sure. Realpython.com/live is where all the information is. You'll find the curriculum, the syllabus, what you'll be covering every week of the course. There's 8 weeks. And it's going to be fun to run. I know that. I always enjoy running these courses. And hopefully those who come, the students, will also find it both entertaining and educational, of course.
Yeah. I'm guessing the plans are to do some more intermediate ones down the road too, if people are at that level.
Absolutely. We started off this new chapter at Real Python of running live courses with intermediate courses. We ran several earlier this year. Anyone listening to this who's intermediate, there's one coming in January. We already have the dates out there as well. And in 2026, we'll also have some other courses, other titles, some more specific perhaps, and some at different levels as well. So this is our second title, if you like, but there's going to be more.
Nice. I want to leave with something kind of, I don't know, like an actionable thing that people can do if they are on a beginner journey. I'm going to suggest that people check out other people's code. There's often these things called an awesome list. And so I'll include a Python project awesome list where people can look at existing code that's out there and try things out. But do you guys have some ideas of, hey, here's something you can kind of check out that might be helpful on your beginner journey?
I feel like because I haven't used LLMs for learning much yet, I was going to say, ask it to, maybe you have a project idea and ask the LLM to write the code for it. But then ask it to explain the different pieces to you. Maybe that could be an interesting exercise that I'd be interested to try. Maybe I should find myself a new topic to learn, such as track and field coach like Stephen, and then and then try an exercise like that to see if how it works for me.
How would you contain the scope of that?
Yeah, I don't know.
That's one of those things that I think about. People end up with kind of grandiose ideas, and I always kind of think about like, okay, well, how can they like keep the whole project in their head, or in this case of an LLM, keep it, you know, the project scope in there? Because often to make it be a finished thing, it's always like this interesting thing, like, okay, well, now we're going to like host it on a website or whatever. Mm. And that becomes like this other kind of like whole bunch of additional skills that somebody's going to need to do that are almost sort of Python adjacent, which I always think is kind of interesting. I mean, that might be something to be in the question there. It's like, oh, I would like to it to run on my machine, or, you know, like other things that you might need to preface there.
But that's like, you already need to know things to ask that question. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, because you need to know about the complexity of deploying something on the web to ask for it not to be part of this project. So
yeah.
I don't know, like my idea, but an untested idea was really just ask it to make the thing without ever thinking about running it or anything. Just ask it to make the thing and then ask it to explain it. Like just keep chatting with it and just see how much you can get out of that.
Yeah, cool.
We've been talking about LLMs and we've mentioned this before, but if you've written some code, you've worked on a project, give it to the LLM and say, I'm learning. This is the limit of my knowledge. What's next? What would you suggest is the next topic I should learn about? Because I think the key is to always realize there's always more topics to learn. No matter how much you know, there's always the next level. You might not have seen it yet. You know, it might be beyond the crest of the mountain, but there's always more topics to learn. I think it's knowing which are the next topics that are the right level for you to learn and to start exploring. LLMs could be good at that. Again, you need to try it out to find out. But
yeah.
And unfortunately, I mean, I want to tie it back to the kind of like the beginning. I still have the feeling like to actually learn it, you're just going to have to put in the time and the work, because you need to get something into your brain. And our brains, if you really want it to be in there, you just need to, you know, repeatedly run this brain pathways.
Yeah. It makes me think of the course that you did about had the kind of debugger stuff going. And I know it was like kind of an advanced question somebody had presented with you, but it showed the process of the code running. I think that is kind of like this maybe a next step thing that people can look at is like, okay, well, let's watch the code run and see what's happening and so forth. And so I think that might be kind of an interesting next step thing once you've got some of the basics under your belt.
We'll be doing a lot of that in Python for beginners, by the way.
Ah, awesome.
I like the technique a lot in teaching, so I use it all the time.
Cool. Well, I want to thank you guys for coming on the show again. It's been fantastic to talk to you.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a great chatting.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to thank my two guests this week, Stephen Grappetta and Martin Broyce. Thanks again for coming on the show. And I want to thank you for listening to The Real Python Podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that The Real Python Podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.